WSMI FM at 10 minutes after 2 o'clock. This is John Michael Marty, and I'm joined at this time by my guest who I've been looking forward to for, well, since I first found out about his book, a new book from an old St. Louis anchorman, and I call him old. I mean that with the most respect because he's been one that I grew up watching, and I'm so thrilled to have him on our show today. His name is Don Marsh. Don, good afternoon, and thanks for joining us today.
John, it's great to be with you. Hello, Litchfield, and I'm glad you corrected that old comment.
I'm old, too, so I should have meant to say I let my kids watch you growing up. I was already grown, but we certainly enjoyed it. Don Marsh has written a new book. The book is called A Wink and a Nod. And the great thing about it is it's a terrific detective novel. I call it a detective novel, even though the main character is not necessarily a detective. He's a lot like Don Marsh was in many ways. Tell us a little bit about this new book, Don.
Well, I'll tell you, he's a lot smarter than Don Marsh ever was. At least I think so. The protagonist is 80 years old, and he's a retired journalist. That's about as close as it comes, although there are some comments early on in the book relating to my recent departure from public radio in St. Louis that just had a little fun with. But otherwise, it's just an old guy trying to help out an old friend find her husband who has been missing for a year or so, and she needs to either get him back or get a death certificate so she can collect on his insurance. And it leads him down a twisted path that takes a few surprises along the way.
It does that. Don, I got the book about a week ago, and I started reading it, and quite frankly, it stuck with me. I didn't want to stop, and I did finally finish it this morning, and I say finally, you get down to the end of a book, you know, it's kind of like you and an old friend have to part company. I must say I was sad that I finished it, but I was very satisfied with the ending, even though it has quite a twist, and that's all I want to say about that.
Yeah, we don't want to give too much away. I'm just finishing a final edit on another book that should be available within a week or two or three. So that's what I'm doing. That's how I'm self-quarantining these days, is just going nuts with the computer.
Well, do we have the same character, or do we have something entirely different?
This is quite different. It's and I think it's a little more ambitious. I would describe it as a modern detective meets historical fiction, if that makes any sense to you. But it's a modern day story, but it traces its roots back to Nazi Germany, and a large part of it is spent during that era. And it all kind of comes together. It begins with two gruesome murders. Modern goes back to Germany to promote some characters, and then ends back in the more modern era.
Oh, it sounds interesting, Don. Let me ask you in A Wink and a Nod, which is your first novel after writing some nonfiction. The thing that I was, I think, most interested in and wanted to find out. Are you a fan of John D. MacDonald? Because certainly your character is.
Are you familiar with John D. MacDonald?
Just only slightly, but you've got me now wanting to go back and read all of his books.
I would heartily recommend that. He is, his main character, protagonist, is not a detective, but he's a guy who also helps people out, but he does it for a fee, half of anything that he recovers, is the way it works. But MacDonald writes engaging stories, but he's a terrific writer. And that's what inspired me to something that, I've always wanted to do. And having read him, I read every one of his books from the very first one to the last in chronological order, which I like to do because it gives you a feeling for the growth of a writer and how they improve over time. But he's just magnificent. He was way ahead of his time. He died about 30-some-odd years ago, wrote 61 books, one of the best-selling authors of all time, and 31 of them related to a character named Travis McGee. And my main character's book, In a Wink and a Nod, is nicknamed Travis McGee. It's kind of an homage to John D. McDonald.
I think it's great. Now, one of the other things that I noticed about your book, and as I read more and more, I kind of get into the point where I can pick out certain characteristics of authors. And I noticed in your particular book, unless I missed it, there was no place where you said the metropolitan area where this takes place. Is that correct?
Yeah. I generally, and the same with the book that I'm just finishing now. It's really not important. I think oftentimes a particular locale is one of the characters in the book, and that was not necessary for what I was trying to do. It was just, you know, it's just kind of any town USA. I do think that there are many successful authors, and McDonald is one of them because he writes about Fort Lauderdale, where he has his houseboat. He lives on a houseboat. And it's a very important character in all of his stories, but it was an unnecessary distraction, perhaps, for what I was trying to do.
Makes perfect sense. Let me ask you, if a person wants to get this book, how do they go about getting A Wink and a Nod?
It's really only available through Amazon. I have an interesting and unusual publication of this book. I had sent it out to a prospective publisher. My two local publishers are really, during this pandemic, are basically cutting way back in what they were doing. So one was not interested because it wasn't St. Louis-centric, and the other just is kind of fallen by the wayside during the pandemic. And I had sent it to a publisher who was interested in publishing it, but said it would take 200 days to get it out. So I came upon a subsidiary, I guess, that Amazon has called Amazon Direct Publishing. And it's not a vanity publishing thing. You don't pay to have your book published. They will publish it. It's all done digitally. And they will produce the books on demand. In other words, they don't publish 1,000 books and hope they sell 1,000 copies. Everybody who orders a book, that they print it specifically for that person, and you know it's in their hands within 2 days. And as I say, it's really an incredible process. It's a little complicated to get the book to them and in the form that you want, but if I can do it, anybody can do it. And I was just astounded at the quality of the book, although the first run did have some printing glitches that I think were the result of the digital world and auto correction and stuff like that. But it's in perfect shape now, and it's a good looking book. Amazon gets a nice cut of any that are sold, but so do I. Actually, more in terms of percentage than was the case with the other books that I had published. So I'm thrilled with it. And the idea of not publishing a whole bunch of books that may have to be sent back and, you know, put in a bonfire someplace is pretty appealing to me.
That definitely is. Don, there's so much I want to talk to you about, and I'm not done talking about the book, but I'm going to take a real short break, and we'll be back in about 2 minutes. Is that all fine by you?
That's great.
Back with Don Marsh here on the radio, 106.1. Big question, Don. When I get done with your book, I was a little sad. I said earlier because I enjoy a good book, and when it's done, it's kind of like the old friend goes away. In the case of you writing the book, you spend a lot more time with that book than I do reading it. How do you feel when you get to the end?
Relieved that it's done. You know, I enjoy. You know, one of the interesting things that I've found in writing a book, particularly of fiction, and this is my first, as you mentioned, is the fact that, you know, I had an idea initially how I wanted it to end. As you say, it's a surprise. And then you have to build it on the basis of making sure that everything leads, you know, to that end and does it in an orderly way. And as I was doing that, and I suspect it's the same with other authors too, different ideas come to you. So you're in a sense, while you're writing it, you're also reading it for the first time, and as you're inventing characters and situations and that sort of thing. So it keeps one amused while they're doing this job. And yeah, when that's over, you're sad, but then, you know, then there's the next project to move on to.
Now, were you writing? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say I have to tell you that I find that the easiest part is writing the book. As this is more specifically to the earlier ones, because this one is really just available, and that is, it's much harder to market it than it is to write it, because I'm not a marketer, and publishers pretty much when they printed the book and when they're kind of through with you, they leave it up to you to get it in the hands of people. I'm not a marketer, and that's difficult to do. There are a lot of book signings and things, which are fine. I don't mind them, but they have to be arranged for, and you have to go out and publicize the fact that you're available to do that sort of thing. That is difficult. It's not an easy thing to do at all. So, I'm grateful to you for giving me this opportunity to talk to some people in your part of Illinois. And, you know, I'll do that as much as I can, but it's necessarily going to cut down on the amount of people that you can reach.
Yeah. Now, the other interesting thing is, in addition to after the book is done and it's available, the marketing part, you were also writing another book. Were you writing them concurrently because an idea came to your head, or has A Wink and a Nod been done for a long time and just now being published? Did it work that way?
A Wink and a Nod has been done probably for 4 or 5 months. This other one is one that I had started a few years ago, and had, because of the press of my work, I just wasn't able to do it on a sustained basis. I get to it, you know, over a matter of days or weeks, and I couldn't spend the time day after day, which I think you have to do to maintain the flow and the continuity of the book. So I wasn't able to do that. So I had it in a drawer, and when A Wink and a Nod was finished, I pulled it out and kind of dusted it off and went back at it, because I've got nothing but time now, and I can devote a lot of time every day to doing it. I'm a fast writer. You know, I've been writing all of my life in the news business, and so it comes easily to me. So that's basically why they've come in such quick succession.
Let's talk about that, because you brought it up, and I think that's a good segue into what I want to talk to you about next. You did write on a deadline all your years as a news anchor. Let's talk a little bit about what it was like being a news anchor during the time that you were on Fox 2 and on KDNL Channel 30 versus what it's like today. And if I could almost guess what you think, I would imagine you may think it's a lot different and maybe not as good or trustworthy. What do you think?
Well, you know, I'm reluctant to sound like one of those old guys who said it was better, you know, when we were doing it back in the old days. It's certainly different. And in some ways, you know, I'm a little disappointed in it today. But let me just go back to the beginning. When I started in television news, it was in Baltimore in 1966. We went out on a story. We carried 600 pounds of camera equipment with us, lights. They were in steamer trunks. All our equipment was in steamer trunks. Today, the technology is that reporters can go out in the field with a camera they can hold in their hands, and they can shoot the story themselves in the field. They can edit it in the field, and then they can report it from the field due to satellite technology. That is so different from the way it was. But, of course, that was a long time ago when I started. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, we had our problems, too. And in the early days of television news here in St. Louis, the big stories were automobile accidents. Well, you know, basically, unless you're in the accident, who cares about it? Today, the big story is crime. I think the local news stations are overloaded with crime news. It's easy to report a crime and have a reporter out in front of some crime t- tape and just say somebody was shot here and killed. Sad as that is, you know, and there's a lot of it going on, that is very easy to report. The story is really, to me, is why? Why is there all this crime? What's being done about it? There's very little attention being given to that, and I think that's where today they kind of fall back a little bit on the kind of reportage that they should be doing. They're doing the easy stuff. Crime is easy to cover. You know,
that makes
causes of crime are difficult.
That makes a lot of sense. Perhaps part of it is the same thing that happens in metropolitan major market radio. The same reason that the music stations, you know, have a real short playlist. It turns over, it turns over. I can't do anything that's going to make somebody push the button. I want to keep them here with me all day long. News, to a certain extent, falls under that same umbrella,
absolutely.
I think.
Absolutely. It's very easy to see, not only in terms of the people who are reporting the news. I'm not talking about the anchors now. I'm talking about the reporters who are universally very young, and while they're talented, and I don't want to say that they're not very, very intelligent, you know, they come into a market and they're here for a year or two before they move on. And that's because the bottom line, as it always has been, is the dollar. And management does not want to, doesn't want to spend a lot of money on reporters, so it's much easier to hire new people. I'll call them kids, if you will. Because, in my demographic, that's what they are. You know, they come in and they're trying to get a foothold in the business, and they'll work for a lot less money. And as soon as they get to the point where maybe they would want to ask for more money, they bring in somebody else. So you have very little institutional memory in these markets, and you're basically now appealing to a different demographic. In my day, the baby boomers, you know, were the ones you were shooting for. Today it's the millennials. It's a difficult thing to do because, to a very large degree, today's millennial generation are stuck. Their jobs aren't there. The jobs are not paying very well. They're living at home. They're saddled with this enormous debt. So, you know, how do you market to a group like that? It's a very difficult thing to have to do. So you've got to make it jazzy. You've got to make it something you think the young viewer will be interested in. Also, they're not watching on television sets. They're watching on their phones. So you've got to keep that in mind in programming. Even the visuals that you select have to be something that, will appear well on a telephone or a tablet. It's a very, very different world out there. The technology is incredible. We went from 600-pound camera equipment to mini cams, which were 60 pounds, and now to these other kinds of cameras and equipment that these young people are carrying around with them. I give them a lot of credit. They're adjusting. I couldn't do it. If I were asked to go out into a news department right now in the city of St. Louis and be a street reporter, I couldn't do it. Because I wouldn't know how to handle the equipment that they've got.
I understand. Don, if I mention some names to you, I wish you'd give me maybe just your opinion. I want to go back. There are many things I want to go back for, but I want to go back and just bring up a few St. Louis anchor names, and I'd like to have your impression or what you think, or maybe some of these were your contemporaries. Some of them even may have been before you. But when I think of the history of St. Louis News, and I guess I owe Frank Abscher some of this, I think of names like John Rodel, and I think of Max Roby, of course, Dick Ford. So many of those guys, they're all, I think, if I had the opportunity to ask each one of those people to come on and talk to me like you and I are today, we would be saying they would be saying the exact same things that you're saying to me, to my question. Don't you think?
I absolutely think so. I mean, I know all of the people that you've spoken with. I worked with Dick Ford for a couple of years at Channel 2 before it was Fox News. I knew Rodel and Max Roby. I'm sure they would say exactly the same thing. I don't know how to describe them, but it more like the elder statesman. I think Rodell was one of the very first to appear on television news here at the city of St. Louis with then KSD.
Right.
I believe he might have been the very first. And Max Roby came along. Max had an unfortunate departure from with then KMOX, which is now KMOV, Channel 4 here in St. Louis. When he mispronounced, this happens from time to time, he mispronounced, there was a play in town called the River Niger, and he mispronounced the Niger part of it in a way that many people took offense to, and it was very, very costly to him. And, you know, you didn't last long then, and you don't last long now if you make that kind of a mistake.
No, not at all. When you think about those people, and you think about your time, because, as I mentioned, I mean, even your time, which was not that far back, the whole way that the audience perceived the newsman was different as well. Look, you cut a dashing figure. But on the other hand, it wasn't necessarily that you had to, and they weren't making you. Today, it's the carryover of what they used to call MTV news. If you get too many wrinkles, you're gone, don't you think?
Yeah, particularly women. I mean, that's always been the case. But yes, I think, as a matter of fact, and I wouldn't go into too much detail on this, but I think that I fell victim to that on two occasions. As ironically, when I first started, believe it or not, at one point, I was obviously a lot younger. I was told that I looked too young. And then 40 or 50 years later, I was told I looked too old. So there you go. I mean, somewhere in between, I guess it was all right. But no, it's an age game. There's no question. Now, I'm speaking of women, and again, I think this is going to change. There are so many talented women who are coming to the fore now. I see this particularly on cable TV, some of the cable networks. They are loaded with female talent. And that was just something that did not exist when I started, and for many years into it. I remember one gal in Baltimore in particular. She was hired, and she was the only woman on the staff, and the only assignments they gave her, you know, were garden club openings and stuff like that, you know, very, very lightweight stuff. And today, I mean, they're covering war zones, and they're covering politics, and they're covering everything, and doing a fantastic job and bringing a great perspective to it. I just love to see it. And you see the same thing happening in local news.
Don, I'm going to take another short break, and then I'm going to ask you something about what you just touched on, and that is the state of political news coverage. I want you to think about that. We'll be back in just a minute or so. Don Marsh is our guest. He has written a wonderful, wonderful book, a terrific work of fiction called A Wink and a Nod. And that book is available on Amazon.com. You can order it from there. And I give it my 5-star recommendation this morning, Don. I really enjoyed it. So if somebody would like to jump in there and read a novel that's got a pretty interesting story, some great characters, and a terrific twist at the end. Wink and a Nod is the book for them on Amazon.
Now, thank you for that. And let me just point out that it's available in paperback and also as an e-book, which is much less expensive, by the way. But it's if anybody is into using their Kindle, there it is, and it's. I'm starting to use Kindle more and more, by the way. So it's a easy way to read a book because you don't have to lug all those pages around.
It's a wonderful thing to have on a plane, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
One question, and our newsman Sean Bellant, who I think you probably know Sean as well from his years in St. Louis.
Oh yeah. Sure.
Sean works as our news director as well, and. One of the things that I wanted to ask your opinion, and I think Sean will weigh in a minute as well, what about the coverage that you see on these presidential races now? I mean, we did not have the the spread, the left and right demarcation between Fox and MSNBC and CNN and Fox and these things. What's your opinion of that?
Well, I think it's proving to be maybe dangerous is too strong a word to use, but maybe not, because all of the stations that you mentioned, the cable networks that you mentioned, come at it from a reticular perspective. And one thing that television does is tries to make its audiences comfortable. And people go where they're comfortable. And people who are on the right are going to Fox, and the people who are more to the left are going to MSNBC. And I think probably CNN tilts a little bit more left than perhaps it used to. But this is tending to cause a large part of the polarization that is so obvious in our country today, because people don't expose themselves to other points of view. They go where they're comfortable. And that, to me, is a real problem. I think it's a problem for the country, because as long as people are just fixated on certain views, and sometimes those views come at them in ways that inspire them to do things that you might not want them to do. I mean, I think there have been some documented cases of violence, for instance, that have been inspired by television commentary, and that's a problem. And it may become, in the months and perhaps even the years ahead, even more of a problem, because this polarization seems to be stabilizing and pretty close to 50-50. And those are Civil War numbers.
Oh yeah, Sean.
Well, you know, Don, I think of Don Marsh. I think of trust. I sit there and I couldn't even begin to guess what your personal politics were. I look at, I always look at the reference to, Walter Cronkite and LBJ saying if I lose him, I lose the country. Or if I lost him, I lost the country. First up, when did we turn that corner where we switch from worrying about trust when we talk about news personnel to putting someone who we can have on a billboard and drive ratings, and how important has that been as far as the loss, I think, of clout for the news anchor, someone who really struck fear in the heart of a politician or a leader to do things on the straight and narrow?
Well, there was a point, and I don't know exactly when it happened, Sean, in which, and thank you for the compliment, by the way. That's a very heavy compliment as far as I'm concerned. But I think it began to happen in two aspects. One, when they decided that they had to have Ken and Barbie doing the news, and all of the attention was placed on the cosmetic. Good-looking guy, good-looking blonde, probably woman, who delivered the news. But I'll take it back even a little bit farther than that. I think it began with Watergate, strangely enough. I think it began when young people at that time began to realize that you could become a celebrity by doing news. You could have a movie made of you of you doing the news if you had the story big enough. I think of All the President's Men and Woodward and Bernstein and how many people they inspired just because they did what they did and then became, and still are, news celebrities. People began to get into the business because maybe they thought they could become famous in that regard. And I don't want to, tar everybody with the same brush, but, I think a lot of people got into that because they thought they could become celebrities. And many did, and many have. And that's not all bad, except it's bad when that's all that's important to them, and they're not really dedicated to the craft.
Do you think, Don, that when people watch, let's say local news, let's throw the cable news out of it for a minute, and let's just say I'm sitting at home and I'm watching my favorite local newscaster at 10 o'clock at night, and do you think that sometimes people get mad enough over what they would say regarding a presidential race to make a switch? I mean, doesn't it take, because you've developed that loyalty, wouldn't it take a whole lot more than maybe deciding somebody said something he shouldn't have said about their candidate to make a switch? It's different than the cable news.
I don't know how loyal local audiences are. I mean, I have no way of judging that. They definitely are to the cable networks, no question about that. But in terms of local news, yeah, I think that people are going to turn if sometimes they see a bias because a reporter or anchor will cover a story and be talking about things that have been said by a candidate, let's say, that they don't agree with. And they'll apply that to the reporter or the anchor delivering the story. And they'll get mad at them. They certainly get mad at them. In my days in television, we had letters all the time for people who were making accusations of bias when there was none. It was the messenger who was being charged with the bias that was actually evidenced by someone else's opinion. But I don't know. I don't think that local news audiences are necessarily loyal, but I don't think they're switching back and forth to any great degree. I don't know. I really don't know the answer to that question.
Don, when you were doing news at Channel 2, were you doing it at the time of the Leisure murder?
Yes.
Did you guys ever fear for your lives at all on reporting that story?
No, I don't think, I don't recall that sort of feeling. It seemed pretty far removed from us. We always showed up after the fact. Perhaps if we had been in the vicinity of one of these incidents, it would be a little bit different. But I don't think the bad guys were targeting news people the way some news people are targeted today by some of the people on either ends of the political spectrum here. The people on the fringes. I think a lot of them are reporters. President Trump, let's face it, during the course of his campaigns, was not doing reporters a favor by singling them out during his rallies, calling them fake news, and even at one or two times, suggested kind of get them out of here, move them out. That is not helpful to the reporters or to journalism or to maintaining any kind of an equilibrium in the room, if you will. I don't remember any kind of fear during those days.
The other interesting thing, and by the way, the book, Wink and a Nod, I always want to go back to that because obviously this is what we're doing today. Wink and a Nod, available on Amazon, either as an ebook for your Kindle or your Kindle app on whatever device you read on, as well as printed work. A Wink and a Nod, available on Amazon.com. Our guest is Don Marsh, former Channel 2 and Channel 30 anchor. And then from 2005 until last year, you were a show host on KWMU. Were you doing classical music? Were you doing news commentary? What was going on there?
It was a daily hour-long interview program. And it was called St. Louis on the Air. It still exists, obviously, with another host. But it was the opportunity to talk to visiting authors, politicians, celebrities, you name it, and take on issues that were important of any particular day. So it was a lot of fun to do because it gave me an opportunity to do a lot of research into a lot of different things. And continue to meet a lot of different people and feel that I still have my hand in the news business.
Well, that is for sure. Now, one thing that you did get a chance to do that I think probably everybody secretly would say, man, I'd love to be in the movies. Back in the, I don't remember what year the movie came out, but there was a great movie with Steven Seagal, a great action star. And Steven Seagal was in a movie called Under Siege. And that movie obviously started out with, I think it was the decommission of the USS Missouri. Is that correct?
Well, it wasn't the decommission. It took place upon the USS Missouri, the storyline did. I don't recall as having been a decommissioning part of it, but yeah, it was. Actually, I think they shot it on the USS Alabama. But
is that right?
That's another story. Yeah, I just, as you mentioned that, I'm looking. I have a huge poster in my office here of Steven Seagal and I don't know why they used his picture and not mine. I was in it for all of 1 minute. And, you know, I still get royalty checks for that thing. I just did narration. It was not an on-camera thing.
And I remember that.
I did it in 1991, and my narration kind of opens the movie, kind of sets the stage. But it was really a very funny and fun experience. I get royalty checks now. How many years later is it? Almost 30 years later. You know,
wow.
Sometimes they'll be $5, $6, but every quarter I get a royalty check. I can't imagine what Seagal gets, you know, for his role in it.
Right. Yeah. What kind of serendipitous moment occurred for you to get that job?
This it was sort of interesting. I was in 1991. I took a ride, how shall say, on the battleship Missouri on its last voyage from Long Beach, California to Pearl Harbor, where it arrived for the 50th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And we got in on December 6th, 1991. And I couldn't do any reportage while on board. I was shooting, making the trip into a documentary. But when we landed, I did some broadcasting from Honolulu by satellite. And somehow, some way, the producers of this movie heard some of my stuff and said, that is kind of the sound that we're looking for. So they contacted me, and I was initially going to record something for them while covering the Republican convention in Houston. That didn't work out, so they flew me to California. I flew out in the morning, showed up at Warner Brothers, recorded my thing, got back on a plane, and was back in St. Louis the same day. But it was two interesting parts of that. I almost missed the plane because George H.W. Bush was coming into St. Louis, and they had a lot of my route to the airport blocked, you know, to make way for his motorcade. But I did get there just in time, and as I say, flew out. We did it in a room. Picture this something the size of two or three hockey arenas put together. It's huge, huge room. And in the room there was a director, a microphone coming out of nowhere from the ceiling. I couldn't even see the end of the microphone cord or cable. Right down in front of me, way off in the corner, there was a sound person. And in this huge room, I just I read the script. And, you know, I did what I had to do and then left. I guess some months later, I guess it would have been early the next year, Under Siege was nominated for an Oscar for sound. And I said to myself, hey, I'm part of the sound.
That's right.
If this damn thing wins an Oscar, I'm going to claim it.
There you go.
I'm going to say that I won an Oscar. Well, the Oscar went to Lion King for sound, so that never happened.
It's been a real pleasure having you with us today. The book, Winking and Nod, is, as mentioned, a great story, but it's not your first book. You'd written a couple others as well. Are those still available, Don, as an e-book, or still available from a publisher?
They still should be available. Probably less so in books. The first one I did in 2008, called Flash Frames, which is kind of a memoir of, if not my story, it's the story of some of the interesting people and places I've been during 50 years or so in my career. I've met an awful lot of interesting people. Worked overseas for 6 or 7 years early on, and you know, gathered a lot of material that I thought would make interesting kind of backstories to a lot of the things that people would have known about. And then I did one called How to Be Rude Politely, which was an attempt at humor and just establishes a lot of situations in which you have an opportunity to get out of a situation tactfully and with grace, or do it rudely. And I give plenty of examples of both, but again, it's just kind of all contrived and made up. It's pretty funny, actually. And then the last one was called Coming of Age, Liver Spots and All, which was definitely a crack at humor, and basically the trials and tribulations and foibles of aging. As I say, it ain't for sissies. And you haven't gotten there, John, yet, I'm sure, but I have. And so I wrote that one with great authority. But again, it's a lot of fun. You know, you can either accept aging as, you know, what it is, or you can look at it through a humorous lens, which is what I try to do.
Well, I have to tell you, A Wink and a Nod was a great read for me, and I think I'm going to tackle that Liver Spots and All book maybe next, and I'll let you know what I think of that as well. It's been a real pleasure having you with us today. Thank you so much. And this interview, by the way, if you happen to our folks listening, if you happen to join in midway through and thought, oh, man, I'm sorry I missed this, it will be up on our website, with your permission, Don, WSMIRadio.com in a couple of days. And, Don, I'll send you the link if you want to put it up on your personal site as well.
Oh, terrific. I'll send you a copy of the Coming of Age book. I've got a few of them here.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Thank you, Don. Thanks so much for being our guest today. Don Marsh, interesting fellow, and a great read, A Wink and a Nod. Thanks, Don.
John, thank you, and thanks also to Sean.
You bet.
Yep.
Oh, thanks, Don.
Take care.